Welcome back to Shattering This. We have Nick calling in from Wisconsin. How can we help you today, my friend?
Good morning.
Good.
We're good.
Good afternoon. Yeah.
So, a few questions about Exodus first.
Okay.
Moshe, you said that one of the five ways, not things that you have to do to become part of Yahweh's family is to walk away from Babylon.
Right.
You know.
That's the prerequisite, is to walk away from your country and from the society that you're ingrained in, and in his case, it was Babylon, and that was not by accident, because Babylon is used throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
Was a Babylon in Egypt?
No.
No.
In the covenant with Abraham, Yahweh tells Abraham to walk away from his country. Now, the country that Abraham was in was Babylon. And so what he's telling us through him, because there's five instructions given to Abraham to participate in the covenant. The first prerequisite was being willing to walk away from political and religious entanglements, which is what Babylon represents. That's how you at least position yourself to approach God. With Moshe was in Egypt. The same conditions that existed in Babylon existed in Egypt. You know, the Pharaoh claimed to be God, just like the king in Babylon claimed to be God. The religion and politics were intertwined.
But the Moses
so very similar.
Was not in Egypt when Yah first spoke to him. He told him to go back into Egypt to get his people out.
Yeah, to go with him to Egypt to free his people. From Egypt. It would be like you and I seeing people in a church, and God said, you know, there's some people in that church that are open to the truth. Go in and let's get them out of there.
All right. I'm reading the Leviticus off of.
And of course, what happened in the Exodus when Yahweh went into Egypt with Moshe. Did he stay there in Egypt with Moshe?
No.
No. Did he try to change Egypt so that the Israelites could stay there and live a better life there?
Well, another question. I mean, no, he didn't.
No, he didn't. What he did is
they
went in only for the purpose of getting his people out.
From what I see and read, Yahweh hardened the heart of Pharaoh.
Right.
I suppose if you make someone stupid just so you could show everyone how you can punish the stupid, that's in its core.
This is often used as by people to say, you know, I think, you know, God was just toying with him. Here's the reality of the situation and what occurred. First, Pharaoh, by his own volition, was choosing to act as if he were God, calling himself God, acting as if God, melding the religion and politics of Egypt together for his own personal benefit, and enslaving the children of Israel. Brutalizing them. He made all those choices of his own volition. They wanted to be free. He continued to enslave them. Those were his choices, free will, bad choices. Yahweh sends Moshe, and he and Moshe go into Egypt and say, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, no, free will. He says, no.
Well, if I would be stupid and I would say no, first, three or four times that Moshe, you know, send the send all those, you know, blood and
flies,
I mean, flies and the thing, lightning and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just first few of those would be enough for me to become a martyr.
You think so?
No, you might.
I'm going to give you a modern example, and then we'll go back to this one. While it was only one occurrence, but when the United States dropped the nuclear bomb on Hiroshima and completely obliterated an entire city of people, men, women, and children, all animals, everything obliterated, the Japanese said, no, we're not going to surrender. It took a second one to do it. Now, in these particular plagues that Yahweh inflicted upon Egypt, he went and quite nicely asked Egypt just to do a simple thing. Let my people go. Just let them go. I'm not going to have you reimburse them for all the free labor. You don't have, just let them go. And he said no. And so Yahweh upped the ante and said, well, let me impress you with make it so that you're more motivated to let them go. And along the way, Pharaoh continued to exercise his own free will and belligerence and said no. And then along the way, as the plagues were ramping up, then Yahweh said, I'm going to harden his heart so that he would not simply say yes just because the pain was way too unbearable. Now, do you know why that occurred? Because you're right, most people, somewhere around the seventh or eighth plague, are going to say, enough already, get them out of here. Why did Yahweh go to all the way to the point that he reached the tenth plague? Why did he, after Pharaoh had been given the opportunity seven or eight times to exercise free will and chose poorly?
I suppose the harsher the punishment, the better the understanding of what you've done wrong?
No. The reason is that the entire Exodus is based upon creating a historical precedence for the path that leads away from countries and politics and religion like existed in Egypt and in Babylon to the Promised Land. And the doorway to the Promised Land is Passover. And so the worst of the plagues was killing the firstborn of the children of Egypt and sparing the firstborn of the children of Israel through Passover. And so Yahweh wanted to get to Passover. He was going to establish a historical precedence for leading his children away from a country that was a religious and political and military and economic mess into the Promised Land. And that doorway was going to begin with Passover. And then the next step was going to be unyeasted bread. And he wanted to demonstrate that that was the first two steps to his home and away from a country. And he did not want Pharaoh to capitulate at step eight get to the last one.
And somewhere in that Exodus, I have read that Yahweh wants everyone to celebrate Passover as a religious custom?
No, never as a religious. Not even a Hebrew word for religion. And Yahweh is opposed to societal customs. He wants everyone to who chooses to be part of his family to celebrate Passover. So if you want to be part of his family, he wants you to celebrate Passover because Passover is the doorway to life and the doorway to his home.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What is the tabernacle? Why is it? Why did he in so much details on how to make it and
mm-hmm.
and like twice he went over it? What is it? Why?
Okay. For him to provide that much detail tells you first and foremost what? I mean, when you just hear, all of a sudden there's this enormous amount of detail on what was
very
first just a... there you go. Very special. Okay, so first thing is the tabernacle is really special. And initially the tabernacle was a tent, and it was called the Tent of the Witness. So we're dealing with a tent, which was a home in those days. I mean, tents were used as a shelter from the elements as a home. So it's a home, and it's a place of witness. And so the primary reason for all the detail is to say, this is where, when you see this tabernacle, I want you to associate with camping out with God. This is his home. Remember the last step of the seven steps that were established in the Torah and in the historical context. The first step is Passover. That's the doorway. But it all the way leads to Sukkah, which is shelters, which is tents, which is camping out with God in his home. So it represents being with God, living with God, camping out with God, which is his ultimate desire for all of us. And then the second is, the only way we're ever going to walk through that doorway that is Passover and take the next six steps so that we end up in shelters camping out with God is to pay attention to his witness. And so this home of his testimony and witness is extraordinarily important. It's the only way we're ever going to find him. And we find that witness in the Torah. And so the Torah and the tabernacle are one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why all the detail. And you know, every one of the ingredients all has symbolic value and merit and helps explain a certain aspect of what it means to be in a relationship with God. You know, what it's a building that is special, which means set apart. Portion part of it was the most set apart. Within the most set apart was the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark is a protective enclosure. The Covenant is the family relationship. The top of the Ark was the mercy seat, where we are forgiven so that we can engage in a relationship with Yahweh. The Torah was always to be adjoining the Ark of the Covenant, carried right along and set beside it to explain what it represents. So,
that's why. What about all them priests that was taking offerings, burn offerings,
yeah, sure,
offerings, and yeah, other offerings?
Okay, Nick, can you stay with us? Can you stay with us over the break? I hear the music playing in the background, and we'll talk about the role of the priests in that community at that time. We'll be back with Nick after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Nick, and his most recent question was, what was the function of having the priests, particularly the priests, engaging on behalf of the sacrifices? The reason, Nick, is primarily that most people during that period of time were illiterate. Only the lucky few could read and write. And so what Yahweh wanted is to have his message communicated to the average folks. And he wanted the symbols that he had established, because all of the sacrifices were symbols representing what he himself was going to do on our behalf on those Moed Mikre, on those invitations. He himself became the Passover lamb. His soul went to Sheol on matzah to resolve our sin. So he wanted the priest to be a literate class that could read his instructions and then carry them out before the people. So when the people would come and participate, for example, in Passover, the priest could help them through the process and actually sprinkle the blood of the Passover lamb on the mercy seat and create a visual way of communicating Yahweh's plan to them. They also acted as judges, because you had a fairly large community, and the constitution was the Torah, and so they made rulings based upon the disputes that arose in any and would arise in any community based on the Torah. So,
well, then a priest, would the priest be the same as a commander? The you remember that when the father-in-law of Moshe told him that he's supposed to he should pick commanders of 10, and commanders of 50, and 100, and 1,000.
Yeah, not necessarily. No, the commanders could be, quite different. And as the children of Israel were moving, when they moved out of the Sinai and began to move up through Saudi Arabia and then approaching the Promised Land, they encountered people that were militant and that wanted to destroy them. So it was appropriate for them to create a militia to protect themselves at that time, and that's why the commanders were chosen. It was really interesting, Nick, on the priests that established some very interesting rules for them. He recognized that in human institutions like Roman Catholicism, for example, but also in Egypt and Babylon, the priests were inordinately rich. They controlled vast tracts of land and the donations went to them. So they were extraordinarily rich and powerful. And Yahweh didn't want them to be rich or powerful. So he precluded them from owning any land. And, in the ancient world, if you didn't own land, you didn't have any power. And second, he precluded monetary donations. The only thing they could receive in terms of gifts from the people were leftover food, scraps of food, if you will, and some wool and some wood. And that was it. So he really kept them from becoming powerful and influential and rich.
So, but when back to Moshe and his father-in-law, mm-hmm. when the reason why his father-in-law have asked him to pick commanders of 10, 100, and 1,000, from what I read, is because he saw people standing in the front of Moshe all day long, and Moshe was sitting down in front of them and judging them according to their...
Yeah. There's a whole long discussion about Moshe's father-in-law saying, hey, man, what you're doing is just not working. What you're doing is you're trying to resolve every dispute yourself. You're trying to teach everybody yourself. And this idea of you trying to resolve everybody's problem and to answer every question just isn't workable. So it's not God telling him that, but it is his father-in-law saying, come on, man, there are too many people who are putting demands on your time, asking you to answer questions and to resolve disputes. You're going to need to be effective, what you need to do is to establish people who can do that for you so that you only resolve the most challenging ones. So it was a way of simply trying to make Moshe a little more effective. And for example, on a small way, but on the Yada Yada website, on the Contact Us, I get so many emails, and the ones that have, really long questions and want to present, 10 pages of information and ask 20 questions, I typically don't answer them. There's just not enough time in the day. All right, my friend Nick, we have any more questions? Happy to entertain them if you do. I'm pleased to hear that you're thinking about and studying the Torah.
The year of Jubilee.
Mm-hmm.
Why would rabbis go hunt the version of Hebrew version of Matan Yah and burn it if the year of Jubilee is right there in Leviticus, I think?
Yeah, it's in Kara, Leviticus. Kara means invite, to call out, to invite, to summon, to welcome.
Why would they then burn the Matan Yah if the year were there? And if it's there, why are they not listening? Why are they, keeping all the land?
It's really interesting that written in English, unfortunately, is Jubilee. It isn't a Jubilee. Who knows how in the world King James came up with that notion. But, of course, kings and queens love the concept of Jubilee years. It's Yobel is the Hebrew term. Yovel means Yah's Lamb is God. Yovel, Yah's Lamb is God. And the purpose of these Yovel years, which was every 50 years, 7 times 7 plus 1, which is the same equation as Shavua, the fourth of the Moed Mikra each year, 7 times 7 plus 1. The things that were supposed to happen on those years were that all slaves would be freed. So it was a time of freedom and liberation. All debts would be forgiven. So it was a time of forgiveness. And that people would, the land would return to Yahweh, so it becomes his home and you could live with him in his home. From an economic point of view, it was designed to allow capitalism to take place, which is the only particularly free enterprise, if you will, which is the only viable economic system, and yet to prevent the accumulation of large tracts of land or money that would be possible if land was not returned. And by the way, this slave being freed was that was the means to production in those days. So it prohibited large fortunes from being passed from one generation to the next. But from a salvation point of view, these Yovel years represented the time that Yahweh would act to make the biggest difference in our lives. And it was in particular, not just on a regular Yovel year, but on the six Yovel years that are the most important to Yahweh. Year 2000 Yah, 4000 Yah, and 6000 Yah. And the reason that those years are more important, the 2000 Yovel, is that everything that's important to Yahweh from a timing point of view is 40. You know, you reign for 40 days and 40 nights. The children of Israel wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. Yahusha fasted 40 days and 40 nights. 40 is always germane. The children of Israel were slaves in Egypt for 400 years. So 40 times 50 is 2,000. So years 2,000 Yah, 4,000 Yah, 6,000 Yah are the most important years. And it was then that Yahweh acted in our lives by first in year 2,000 Yah, 1968 BCE, establishing the covenant on Mount Moriah with Abraham. 2,000 years later, year 4,000 Yah, which is 33 CE, he is himself fulfilling Pesach, Matzah, Bekodim, and Shavua in Jerusalem as Yahusha. And year 6,000 Yah, which is 19 years from now, he's going to return and reestablish the entire earth back to the conditions experienced in the Garden of Eden. So those Yovels are the most important times within the calendar of events. You mentioned rabbis. At the time of the Torah was written, there were no rabbis. The first rabbis came into existence around 200 BCE. And the rabbis sort of emerged in a fight between the priests had gone against Yahweh's instructions. The Lowi, called Levites today, had gone against Yahweh's instructions, and they started to assimilate wealth, both land, powerful titles, and authority. And so they had power and wealth. And they were using it in a way that was inconsistent with the Torah instructions. And the rabbis said, you know, you're being born into this. And the rabbis were like the enlightened group that said, we're smarter than you are. We want that control. And the Maccabean revolt was largely in as a result, even though it was waged against the Greek oppression. One of the two groups, the rabbis, were a bit more willing to accommodate the Greeks than were the priests. They ended up fighting a war with the Greeks, had some limited success, but it created the rift between the rabbis, those who wanted to usurp religious authority, and the priests who had elevated themselves beyond the Torah's instructions. So that's when they began. And what's interesting with the rabbis is the rabbis knew that year 4000 Yah was the time that the Masiyah was going to arrive. And they know that they knew that God's plan was to return in year 6000 Yah. They all knew in 33 CE what was going to happen. That just that when he arrived, he was so opposed to them, so anti-religious, that they had a very difficult time with that, and which is why they went ahead and tried to get him killed, because he was opposed to them, even though they knew that 33 CE was year 4000 Yah, and that's when the Masiyah was scheduled to arrive.
Boy, if you would ever stop doing the show here and there, who else would answer all those questions then?
You know, the fun part of answering questions, Nick, is when, if you can ask a question that provides an opportunity to share information that's useful. I mean the rabbis being stupid relative to the Yobel, that might be interesting, but to broaden it and say, you know, here's the context of the Yobel, and here's the context of the rabbis, and why they ended up being stupid. I personally think that's fun, to enjoyable, enlightening. You know, to try to put it all in context and tell the story from Yah's perspective. The Yobels are really important. That's why I'm glad you mentioned them. It's interesting, though, that, of course, that the people that Yah encouraged to celebrate the Yobel don't. The last Yobel celebrated in Yisrael. Really telling. You know when it was?
What?
133 CE.
Wow.
133 CE marks the second of the Judean wars against Rome. And Rabbi Akiva, who was the founder of Rabbinic Judaism, Rabbi Akiva knew that year 33, 2 Yobels ago, was the time that the Masiyah had to arrive. And so since they didn't want to acknowledge Yosha as being the Masiyah, he invented a renamed Bar Kokhba, son of a star, and renamed him and declared that he was the Masiyah in the Yobel year of 133. And then said, behind this Masiyah of Rabbinic Judaism, we're going to lead a successful revolt against Rome. And that was the last Yobel year celebrated by Yehudim anywhere in the world.
So then how am I supposed to follow the instructions? There is no Israel land.
Uh-huh.
So I suppose I can. I'm not supposed to own anything in this land where
no.
I am.
Well, am I ever glad you asked that question. The answer, of course, is you're a rational guy. It's impossible. It is impossible for you to do what that Torah instruction says. You can't today set up loans that have a zero balance on a Yobel year. You can't today free your slaves because, you immigrated here in the United States, and if you own any slaves to free, you're in serious trouble. And there is no bank that's going to establish, or you can't establish a loan that's based on the Yobel criterion. And you don't own any land in Yisrael, do you?
No.
So it's absolutely impossible for you to do any one of those three things, isn't it?
No.
Yep. Absolutely impossible. You can't do any one of those three things. Now, can you benefit from knowing that the Torah speaks about a Yobel year being a time when slaves are freed? Can you equate to that to something that's important, that maybe you're being liberated by the Torah and that this is part of God's plan? And that, can you equate debts being forgiven to you being forgiven of everything you've ever done that's wrong, so that...
Well, on that year, I may forgive any debt that someone owes me, or... But what about the land?
No, what I'm saying here is...
If I bought it from someone...
No, that's not what I'm saying here, Nick.
Do I also give it back?
You can't do these instructions, but you can learn from them. And that's why the book that they're included on is called Instructions, Teaching. So what I'm saying is that every moment, any year, every year, at any part of any year, you can fully gain from an understanding of the Yobel. You can know that it is God's plan to liberate us, not to enslave us, to free us. That you know that it's God's plan for us to be able to camp out with Him in His home, in His land. You know,
whether you want it or not, God is going to come back and He's going
to... You get to inherit all that is His to give. That's His plan. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Nick, your question on, you know, how do you do the act upon the instructions regarding the Yobel happens to be my favorite question. Of all the questions you could possibly ask, it's my favorite question, because the answer is you can't. And because you can't, and because the Yobel is so important, and the Yobel is almost as important as each of the seven individual Moed Mikrei. It's probably third to the covenant in terms of importance, in terms of its message with the Yahweh. And when you can't do something that is that important, it screams to me that this book that this message is contained in is called Instructions. And it's guidance from our Heavenly Father. And since you can't do it, you need to think about, then, why is it there? And it's there so that you can learn from it. It's not there
just
for you,
like,
to do.
Just like the walking away from Babylon.
Correct.
You can't walk away from it. I was
right.
Explaining my kid the other day, how do you walk away from Babylon,
yes,
and not to be in Babylon.
Correct.
And so the Yobel is like the same thing. You can't really do it, but
right.
But
you can experience it.
Exercising your nesoma. Huh?
Yes, exactly.
You understand that all from, if I understand right, all it is, it's about you forgiving and not
being forgiven. Forgiving and being forgiven.
Well, to be forgiven, you have to
right.
meet another guy who's going to be have a conscience and
right.
Understand and believe in.
Right.
You know, in
well, Bible. By being forgiven by God.
Mm-hmm.
And right. being liberated by God. In fact, what you are doing with your son is exactly the purpose of the Torah. Fatherly advice, teaching from our Heavenly Father to you, just as you were teaching your son how to think through the process
yeah,
of what
I
it means.
I don't have no sons. I have girls. And by the way, either it's in instructions or where did I read it, it's just mind-boggling. Back in time, it was okay to sell your daughter into slavery.
Yeah, back in time it was. Yeah, it happened a lot. As a matter of fact, it happens every day. Today in the Islamic world, the dowries for daughters, you're selling your daughter into slavery because she has no rights with her husband. She has no say as to whether or not she wants to be married to that guy. And marriage in Islam isn't like marriage in the West. She becomes his property. And so every day in the Islamic world, women are sold into slavery.
And unlike the male slaves who can go out, who can be freed on the seventh year, the woman slaves have no right to be freed. They, I mean, what is that about? Why? girls go out on the 7th year.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, that's the whole purpose of the Yovel. Everyone is freed. So it's a it is a universal freeing act, and and by way of the Torah's liberation, when a woman participates in the covenant family, she is freed spiritually and gets to be part of Yahweh's family and live forever. So, you know, in that sense, freedom exists for everyone. Yahweh doesn't ever encourage slavery, and he is overtly in favor of liberating us from slavery. That's why he went into to free men, women, and children from being slaves in Egypt. He didn't just free the men; he freed men, women, and children from being slaves in Egypt. So he is overtly in favor of liberation. Humankind, though, for all but the last really several hundred years of our existence, has been all about slavery, though, and that's just been the custom of man.
What about the you know, I'm again in Leviticus 16. And he who blemishes the name of Yahweh surely shall die.
Right.
This is like no different than Muslims want to cut your tongue out if you say something bad about Muhammad.
Yeah, it's this is not about an individual. This is Yahweh saying that if you besmirch his name, you're going to die. And everyone
not
who is not engaged...
Cast stones at him.
You're gonna die if you're opposed to Yahweh and his name. You're gonna die.